The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. One of the highlights of the scientific calendar here in the UK is the Royal Institution's Christmas lectures. They've been going since 1825, when Michael Faraday launched his attempt to bring science to young people. They've run every year since, except during the Second World War, and lecturers have included David Attenborough, Richard Dawkins, and Dame Nancy Rothwell. This year, we'll get 3 one-hour lectures entitled Meet Your Brain, with Bristol University psychologist Professor Bruce Hood. He'll unveil how the brain is constructed and how it creates the world we perceive around us. As Bruce rehearsed his lectures, which will be shown after Christmas on BBC Four, we caught up with him to discuss his research and to get a sneak peek at what he'll be saying in his talks.
Okay, so have a look at these two pictures of the same person smiling. Which one do you think is a genuine smile and which one is faked?
That one's genuine and that one's fake.
Is she correct? Yes.
Yeah. So Bruce, why don't you tell us what your lectures are about?
Well, the lectures are in three. The first lecture is simply called What's Inside Your Head? And that's really an introduction to the structure of the brain and the basic building blocks of the brain, and how something like a brain can encode information about the world. The second lecture is Who's in Charge Anyway? And that's more to do with the function of the brain, how it controls our behaviors and thoughts. And the final lecture is Are You Thinking What I'm Thinking? Which is really to do with the idea that the brain has evolved as a social brain and that humans are particularly social. We've evolved these abilities to interpret and see other people.
Let's start with the basics then. What that actually is inside your head, and we think of what's inside our head as like a giant cauliflower that's maybe a bit soft. What is that? What is that stuff?
Well, it's densely packed. The brain is about 7 times heavier than you'd imagine for an animal of our size. A human brain is extraordinarily large, and it's full of billions upon billions, somewhere about 170 billion brain cells. And then there are neurons, which are a particular type of brain cell, which are the ones which do all the clever stuff. They're the ones that encode information. But it's not so much the number of the cells. It's really fascinating. It's the connections between the cells, because that's actually the secret to the processing power of the brain, because it's connections which encodes information.
So these connections are being made and unmade all throughout our lives.
Yeah, now this is one of the really surprising things, because most people think that you're growing brain cells all the time. In fact, you've got almost your full complement of brain cells when you're born as a baby. And what's really changing and explaining the size and the change in weight is this increase of connections.
And these networks are what encode memories and skills and all sorts of things.
Well, effectively, memories and any aspect of learning, anything which is stored is encoded in these connections.
And so, I mean, this is one of those questions which I suppose I ask anyone who's into neuroscience or on the edges of consciousness. How does that create this illusion of reality we
That's
have all around
so
us?
That's so unfair.
Let's just start with that.
Oh, you went for the big one right from the start.
Can you do it in 1 minute?
Yes, well, no, we can't really understand that at the moment. There are lots of pet theories and speculations. How can something immaterial arise from a material?
What are you going to tell the audience at the RI?
Well, I'm going to try and do it without confusing them in a way. I think the main take-home point I'm going to give them is the idea that the brain is representing the external world, and that's the origin of the world, representation. So a representation is a representation. So you're encoding experiences and storing that, and when the brain then brings these back to think about them, it's almost recreating the original experience. But of course, nothing is stored most memories are flexible. It's not like a photograph captured in time. These things are constantly dynamic and changing.
Now, I'm not going to go into consciousness because I think that will be a whole discussion by itself.
Yeah.
But the conscious brain that we are aware of, the sort of reality, is only one small part of what's going on and buzzing around electrically in your head.
Sure. I mean, we're only aware of what we need to be aware of, and that tends to be those sorts of tasks or problems where you have to reflect upon them or use attention to try and solve them. Most of what the brain does is actually unconscious.
And so what are they? Well, what is it just the mundane stuff? Is it just regulating hormones and making your arms move around?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of the things that the brain does is automatically, offline, if it were, you know, things like heart rate and respiration, digestion. Just about every aspect of the body has some sort of neural representation in the brain. So you don't really need to think about, you know, your heart rate, although, of course, you can change it by thinking certain thoughts. But what most people tend to be interested in is problem solving and the intelligence, the memories, the language, all those things which seem to be, almost the mark of what, you know, human thinking is all about, and that's tends to be, you know, the content of consciousness.
And so we're aware of our mental states and what we can remember and the sort of problems and math problems or bus timetables, whatever else it is. But how does whatever agencies within you in your brain decide what to make you aware of and what to sort of just push back to somewhere else?
Well, I think that these representations of all the experiences you've had are brought to bear upon problems. And it's almost as if the brain is constantly juggling a series of competing influences and impulses and goals, trying to achieve the best solution. So consciousness, in many ways, is reflecting upon these competing drives on the brain and helping you resolve that. By creating a kind of a working mental space.
And you're giving this lecture in front of a whole audience of people in the Faraday Lecture Theatre. So, I mean, are there things you're going to show them which demonstrate the fact that we're not aware of lots of stuff around?
Oh, yeah, of course. So I suppose everyone's familiar with illusions. So that's showing how the brain fills in missing information quite often. Illusions really demonstrate very dramatically how your brain is imposing structure and order on the world, and that's what an illusion is very often you're experiencing something which isn't there, or you're experiencing something which isn't what it really is. But the issues of attention, we're going to be showing how that when you have your attention focused in one part of the world, you're often missing other things going on. So you can't be aware of everything at the same time. So the metaphor is usually a bit like a spotlight, that anything that falls under the spotlight is clearly illuminated. But if experiences are falling outside of the spotlight, then you don't notice them.
So I mean, we're all very conscious of the fact that we whatever we can see or experience, that's what's happening. But is that always the case?
Well, and that's one of the grand illusions, of course, is that we think, especially, for example, if you consider vision, when we look around the world, we assume it's sort of rich and fully detailed. But in fact, you're actually only ever aware of or processing the central part of your visual field. And it's only because you can move your eyes and you have certain expectations about what the world is that you get this rich experience. And one of the very simple but very most powerful demonstrations of the fact that we're going to show that you can't even see, you know, when you're moving your eyes, you can't see the world. And, you know, this is a simple demonstration where you can look in a mirror, and if you shift your attention from one eye to the other, you can never see your own eye movements moving. And that's because your brain is literally switching off the world in between. And it's just a safety mechanism to make sure that you don't see this sort of smearing world as your eyes are moving.
And you can drive yourself mad trying to look at your eyes moving. I mean, I'm sure every kid's done it.
Yeah, it's going
to
be...
try and catch yourself.
I think it's going to be just one of those very simple things that hopefully from this lectures they're going to kind of try out at home.
I mean, the illusions, which you mentioned earlier, this is the basic of all magic tricks. And what fascinates me, I suppose, in the last few decades is that magicians and master illusionists are being studied by neuroscientists and psychologists to actually understand how the brain works, which seems counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, in fact, Penn and Teller are very famous illusionists and magicians. And Teller has published a paper in a neuroscience journal. So he's got a real deep interest in the neuroscience of magic. And as you said, a lot of it is to do with misdirection of attention. Because we're social animals, we tend to automatically follow somebody else. And so what magicians are very skilled at is manipulating that and controlling where our attention is focused, and whilst they do something, you know, surreptitiously that we don't see.
And then I suppose your brain constructs a narrative with the pieces of information it thinks it has, rather than what's actually there.
That's right, yeah. So you never expect to see a rabbit under the hat, and therefore you're quite surprised.
Which is terrifying. Yeah. And your third lecture, all about sort of the social aspects of the brain. So we've talked about the brain and how it integrates information from all around us to give us our experiences and the various problems involved in that. But we don't live by ourselves generally. We live in a group. And so how does that affect our experience of the world?
Well, one of the things that we've come to appreciate in recent years, and I'm a developmental psychologist, so I study children, is that childhood used to be thought of as a time of immaturity, but we now realize that this is actually a period where we're becoming social. And if you think about it, the species which have the longest periods of childhood tend to be the ones which are actually more flexible or intelligent, if you want to use that word. So humans have the longest period of childhood, and I think really what's going on there is that they're learning not only from others, but learning to become like others. And so in the third lecture, I'll be describing that journey from early childhood through to adolescence and indeed on to adulthood, and trying to reframe it in a way that makes sense as a social process, not simply just learning information.
When you say adolescence and childhood, I mean, in total, that's what, 18 or so years for human beings. That seems like a long time to learn how to hang around other human beings. I mean, it should be very natural.
Yeah, I mean, just to draw a comparison, if you consider different species, for example, chickens and birds like rooks or cravens, chickens are up and running within a couple of hours and, you know, they can reproduce within about 5 months, whereas other birds spend long periods of time. So they're both birds, but if you look at their behaviors, the chickens are very rigid in their ability to solve problems, whereas rooks and cravens are very skilled, and they spend up to 2 years of their life as fledglings. So I think it's the same mechanism operating in humans, that we spend up to, you know, 15 to 20 years up to adolescence, and that's a large proportion of human lifespan. And that can only be because it serves a really important process, which I think is learning from others and learning to communicate and share information. And humans, of course, also have skills which we think are fairly unique now in the animal kingdom. I mean, other animals can read each other's behaviors, but we don't just simply read behaviors. We put ourselves in other humans' shoes. So we take their perspectives. We can empathize. We can see their points of view. This is a whole area called theory of mind. And it's really important, because without a theory of mind, you can't anticipate what other people are thinking or doing.
Does all of this have a physical effect on the brain? Does your brain wire itself differently if you're very sociable compared to if you're not?
Yes, we think so. I mean, certainly the frontal lobe areas, which are the most expanded in humans, these are continuing to rewire and wire up all the way through into adolescence. So, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence.
Does it sort of leak out? I mean, I can tell what you're thinking from looking at your eyes and face and so on. But does that mean that I'm anthropomorphizing things unnecessarily? I mean, is that a problem?
Well, that's right. Anthropomorphism is really it's a very difficult thing to avoid. Dan Dennett, the philosopher, thinks that we automatically take an intentional stance to many things simply as a way of interacting with them. And if we think about them as human-like, we can see them as purposeful and interact with them in a meaningful way.
And that can everything from what your pets to
your computer.
Computers.
Yeah,
and you think it's out to get you, and it doesn't work.
That's right. It's being malevolent and vindictive. Yeah. That's right. We'll treat anything as if it could be human-like.
And is that also why? I mean, you've written about this in the past. Is this also perhaps why we're willing to believe in supernatural, superstitious things, like, for example, seeing faces in toast or in clouds or something?
That's right. I mean, seeing faces is a very common thing, because faces are the most important social stimuli to humans. And in fact, we have areas of our brain which seem to be dedicated to processing faces. The problem is, of course, that we've become tripwired to seeing anything that could be face-like. And in the past, this has often explained why people see faces in clouds and trees. And often, religious deities, these are the sorts of things that people will spot. And a more general point, and I've written about in the past, is the way that supernatural beliefs really can be considered not so much the fact that we're indoctrinating children with misconceptions or supernatural stories, but they may emerge simply as a way that the child is interpreting the world in the first place. And all that culture does is it provides a framework to make sense of those ideas.
So take us through that a little bit. So what kinds of things are children thinking that we sort of maybe
okay, so one of the things I'm really interested in is called essentialism. And this is the idea that there's an internal property to the living world, which makes things what they truly are. So, for example, children at 3 to 4 years of age will know that cats are different from dogs, but they can do that over and beyond the outward appearance. They start to think there must be something inside a cat which makes it different to a dog, like a catty essence, if you like. So they're starting to infer a deeper property to the living world. Now, that idea that there might be something inside a living thing, I think could be the basis for all manner of supernatural beliefs about contamination. For example, what makes someone a bad person? It could be that they have some sort of evil essence. And in fact, our language betrays this sort of beliefs because we talk about people being evil to the core. And this is one of the research questions I've been pursuing in recent years, is that adults' attitudes to the idea of moral contamination, you know, do objects become contaminated by contact? So that's the sort of thing we've been looking at.
There's a famous example of this that you did. One of my colleagues wrote about in 2006, which is about a special type of cardigan. Take us through that.
Yes, this was a demonstration based on a piece of work that had been done by Paul Rosen. And I was at a press conference for a science meeting, and I held up a cardigan and asked if anyone would be willing to wear it for £10. And the hands went up. And then, of course, I said, would you still wear it if you knew that this belonged to Frederick West, the mass murderer? And, of course, the hands came down. And that's an interesting phenomenon. Why don't you want to wear clothing which has been worn by a murderer? Now, of course, you can come up with a whole lot of post hoc kind of explanations. Well, you know, I don't want to be seen to be someone who would do something which everyone regards as bad. But that just resets the question again. Well, why do other people think that wearing clothing of murderers is something which is wrong? And I think a lot of the explanation can be brought back to this idea of essentialism, that there's something that could be almost transmitted. Because after all, we don't know why people are killers. We don't know why people behave badly. Maybe there is some biological property which could be transmitted. So this idea is something that we've been looking at in recent research.
Was it actually Fred West's cardigan?
No, of course not. No. I mean, it's just the belief is sufficient. And it can work the other way, of course, because actually in the talk, I then went on to produce Einstein's fountain pen, and people wanted to hold that, which is, it's really interesting. I think this is the basis of why we go to museums and we go to collections and we want to see the original objects, because as soon as we discover it's not the original, then our regard for it disappears.
And so how do you sort of investigate that more? When you said you set up these questions, why do people not want to wear the out clothes of a murderer? Why does someone want to hold Einstein's pen? Mm. But that question still remains. The fact is that you found that happens. They do want to do those things,
yeah,
or not. But what is? How do you begin to tease that out?
Well, I suppose one of the biggest problems of saying it's an essentialism is to say, well, it's the counter. Well, it could just be association. It's just the idea is that when you hear these words, you have all these negative things triggered in your mind. So we've been trying to unpack that to see whether it's actually the physical contact which makes a difference, or just simply the knowledge that the object is supposedly belonging to a murderer. And we've got some work that's coming out, we're working on at the moment, which suggests that it is actually the physical contact, which would explain a lot of behaviors across different cultures, the need to cleanse oneself. If you think about it, lots of societies have this need to wash away the sins. So there is this idea, it's almost like a physical contaminant.
What happens in the digital world? I mean, are there digital versions of these sorts of conundrums?
That's a fascinating question, because I was really, for example, I collect posters. You know, I collect movie posters from the 1950s. And even though I understand and I'm aware of my, irrational thinking, I still can't get over this idea that it has to be the original. But what happens when you move to an era where everything becomes digital? For example, people collect records and they collect objects. But we're increasingly starting to store music no longer on a record. It's digital download.
You don't have the liner notes.
Yeah, so one might think that, you know, we're going to enter a new technological era where there is no authenticity anymore. And in fact, the whole notion of, you know, identity of ourselves, you know, if we're starting to replace body parts. And it's a really fascinating, brave new world. What happens when the original material can actually be digitally encoded? And I don't know yet, but my gut reaction is that I think that we'll still just shift our essentialism towards objects which can't be replaced by a digital copy. So I think there's almost like an underlying need to have sacred objects. I've called them sacred objects in the past, this idea they're objects which can't be easily duplicated or owned by anyone. It's as if they have to have this unique position in society. And it may not be a digital recording, but it might be something else. And interestingly enough, I think even though the digital era has changed the way the music industry works, it's still interesting to know that people do want to go out and see the bands live again to make that social contact.
So even when there's things like music or film, for example, where it's an ephemeral experience that has an emotional impact, perhaps, that you remember and you enjoy, do you still need that physical object of some sort, as a cassette or a DVD or a piece of vinyl, to link you to it? I mean, does it ever go away?
Well, I mean, maybe need is a strong word, but certainly there's a desire, and that's obviously the basis for why people collect memorabilia and pay large amounts of money for these artifacts. It's why museums exist in many ways. In fact, many objects in museums are not even the originals, but just the belief it's the original is sufficient.
That's actually terrifying to think, actually, that we're being lied to in museums. Let's not go down there. Let's not go down there. But is this a healthy thing? I mean, this is completely normal that we're sort of slightly obsessed with things being real and normal.
Well, it seems to be very common. One of the things we've been doing research on is teddy bears, sentimental objects, and they're very common in the West in particular. Not so common in the East, interestingly enough, and it could be something to do with the way we rear our children. So in the West, we typically have, we separate them for sleeping purposes about the second year, whereas in Eastern cultures, the children will sleep with their mothers well into middle childhood. Now, it could simply be the case that when you put a child into a different room, they need to self-soothe. And objects which are soft and in the crib is something they form, you know, an attachment to. So it's a simple kind of associative learning principle. But certainly by the time they're 2 to 3 years of age, these are no longer just objects. These are things which are sentient. These are irreplaceable. These are either the blankets or the teddy bears. And now most children grow out of it. And especially if you're a boy, and I suspect that reflects the fact that you can't take your teddy bear to the playground without getting teased. But actually, a lot of adults go on to keep their teddy bears. And so we've been looking at these adults who are now in their early 20s and testing their attitudes to the perceived destruction of them, if they have to cut up a photograph of them. We published a paper earlier this year where we stuck these electrodes on them, which measure their arousal, which is effectively...
Not on the teddy bears.
On their skin. It's how distressed they are. And then we got them to cut up photographs of valuable objects that they owned or somebody else's teddy bear. And then we got them to cut up the photograph of their own. And we've got these significant effects showing that even though they know it's a photograph, it's still distressing. So the symbolic destruction is pretty upsetting.
Does that tell you there's a different type of person that enjoys that sort of thing or worries about that? Or is it just that it's in all of us?
I don't know if it's in all of us. And I think there's definitely some individual differences there. We haven't actually been able to unpack what those are. And that's another area of research for the future. But the fact that we've got people who are fully aware that this is just actually never going to destroy the object, and even the fact that it's a childhood object, is interesting, and that it produces physiological changes. So we're coming to the end of a series of studies that we've been doing brain imaging, looking at activation in the brain as adults watch destruction sequences. So I had a lot of fun in the summer last year filming destruction sequences of a box. So we blew it up and chainsawed it and jumped up and down on it. And then we cut that sequence with a picture of their object going into the box. So when you're lying in the scanner, you're watching these events where your teddy bear appears to be put into a box and then exploded. And we wanted to see how that what kind of reaction that created in the minds of the in the brains, I should say.
Did you enjoy all this?
Well, it's very sadistic, isn't it? I mean, my research should be a lot of fun.
It's a good job that they haven't found the teddy bear you really love and destroyed that. What about this as a conundrum? I'm still fascinated by this idea of something having to be real.
Yeah.
What if you were to take your teddy bear from when you were 5 years old and recreate every single atom of it in perfect, as in the physical universe could not tell you the difference between the two things? Does that make a difference to your perception of it?
Well, of course, this is the conundrum that's often used by philosophers. What happens if you replace every molecule, every atom? At what point does it lose its identity?
And at that point, it's the same thing.
It's the same idea, exactly. And so it's not just authenticity of inanimate objects, it's authenticity of us. And actually, we are replacing ourselves through our lifetime anyway, so there's very little original material by the time you're middle-aged. You've replaced almost all your cells. Some of them are still original from fetal cells, but a lot of them have been changed. And the idea that you could replace someone is something which is abhorrent, because there's all these scenarios where you get into a machine that transports you to Mars. And it's been the basis of a number of good science fiction stories and movies and films about that question. I think deep down psychologically, we have to have continuity. In other words, we have to think that we're dealing with the same person. And as soon as it seems that they've been changed or replaced, then that's a difficult thing to get our minds around.
But what about the objects as well?
I mean, the same thing happens with the objects as well.
You still imprint upon those objects the fact that it's different.
Somehow. So there's been studies showing that what's children's intuitions about an object which is gradually changed. It's sometimes called the ship of Theseus problem. It's an ancient philosophical notion that if you gradually replace an object piece by piece, people treat it as the same object. If it suddenly goes through a rapid, sudden transition so that every part of it is changed, then you treat it as a completely different one. So we can deal with gradual transformations, but what we don't treat as the same thing is if it's a sudden transformation.
Okay, let's talk a bit more about the lectures themselves. What will people see? What will it look like? What can they expect?
It's been a real challenge, to be honest, because when I was asked to do this, I thought, there'll be thousands of demonstrations and phenomena which we can easily reproduce. But when I started to research for it and come up with the ideas, I suddenly realized it's a big problem that many of the things that we're talking about are, first of all, very subjective in the mind. And secondly, they depend or they occur in circumstances which are very different from being in a public arena in front of, a couple of hundred other adolescents. So it has been very difficult coming up with good examples. But we've done very well, I think. And so we're going to show some classics, which we know are very reliable, but we're also going to go out on a limb and try some things which should work. And, as I speak, we're still just trying things out to see if it's going to...
Illusions and that kind of thing.
The thing about illusions is that they work, because that's one of the robust things about illusions, is that even when you know what you're seeing, they're going to occur. But you don't want to have three lectures on illusions. that's not the story that we want to create. Although one of the take-home messages I am giving the audience is that your reality, your world of experience is created. So you have no direct contact with reality. Your brain is always interpreting the outside world. And that's why illusions are so powerful, because they show that very dramatically. But the remaining lectures are more challenging, because we have to come up with things which are relevant to the children and then they can relate to, but do in a way which is visually interesting.
Now, talking about visually interesting, the sets look like a sort of B-movie horror film.
Yeah,
and you smiled as I said that, so you must have had some.
I was delighted. Because I'm fascinated with, and I have always been fascinated with science fiction, especially science fiction that delves into horror. And the golden era of that was, of course, the 1950s and 60s. So this is part of my childhood, sentimentality. And when they visited me to come to my office, I have some of these up and hanging in my office, these posters. And I think this this click with them, I thought it'd make a nice theme. So I was delighted that they went with that.
So you walk into a B-movie lecture theatre, basically. Expecting a professor to come and eat your brains?
We had to be careful because, we're actually starting off with real brains. So we don't want to trivialize anything. But, of course, this is a young audience, and so it has to be relevant to them. It's going to look a little bit like underneath in the storeroom underneath the cinema. So I'll be kind of almost this guy lurking underneath the movie theatre.
What is it you want the... audience, and you mentioned children several times who are going to be in the audience, but I mean there are going to be people who aren't children watching this and who probably know less than the children in terms of what the brain does and is. And all the people on TV, what do you want them to actually get from this series?
What an amazing thing the brain is. It's surprisingly sophisticated. We take it for granted. I mean, the things that we do every day, we just don't understand exactly how complicated they really are. And I want them to come away with a sense of wonder about how a thing like the brain has such flexibility and yet such powerful, processing capability to create this experience that we have. So it's a wonder at this organ, but also wonder of what it does in terms of what we phenomenologically experience. So that's one of the things I think is probably the important take-home message.
Do you want to create some budding neuroscientists as well?
Well, I'm really hoping so, because I'm going to leave open a lot of questions. I'm going to raise a lot of questions, and hopefully they'll see that this has got many years of work in the future. And I think hopefully it's going to be inspiring.
Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much to Professor Bruce Hood and the Royal Institution. His lectures will be broadcast on BBC 4 at 8 p.m. on the 27th, 28th and 29th of December. They'll also be available on the BBC iPlayer after that. For more information about the Royal Institution, just visit their action-packed website at rigb.org. That's all we have for this show this week and for this year. A big thanks to all our guests and to you, dear listeners, for doing what you do best, listening. For breaking science news at any time, now or over the holidays, just go to our website, guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, we wish you a very happy new year. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.